Blog Talk Radio.
I don't care what I accomplish in my life. I realize that I need the Lord. You need the Lord tonight if you just look to the hills from whence cometh your help. Your help comes from the Lord. I need you like the ocean needs the water, or it will run dry. I need you like the many stars above, needs the setting of the sky. I need you like tomorrow needs the hours of today to pass by. Lord, I need you more than ever, so hear my humble cry. I need the oil. I need thee. Every hour I need thee.
Prophecy so astonishing that
people have tried to discredit it by saying it was written after the fact, which doesn't hold water because it's easily demonstrated that the book of Second Esdras existed long ago. And then we also dealt a bit with the spear of destiny. The spear of destiny was reputed to be the spear that pierced Jesus' side. The folklore that accompanies that particular artifact, all the way from the time of Jesus to the Second World War and beyond, it was reputed to have been in the hands of Hitler. A witness said that after he held it in his hands, he changed and walked away as if he was in a trance. I don't know if that's true or not. It was captured by Eisenhower's troops. And when they reported to Eisenhower that they had this artifact, Eisenhower says, "We don't want that. Let the Russians have it." And as far as we know, that they're the last possessors of the Spear of Destiny. We also touched a bit on the work of the late Professor Carol Quigley. Carol Quigley is the author of two prominent books, The Anglo-American Establishment and Tragedy and Hope. Professor Quigley was a mentor and professor to Bill Clinton. There's many instances you can find on the internet where Bill Clinton mentions Professor Quigley. And Professor Quigley basically writes a couple of tell-all books about what went on behind the scenes in history. All of these things geared toward the reality that God is in control of the broad strokes of history in the background. That being my reason for exposing us to some of this material. And then last week we played something that I'm going to continue this week, and that was from the work of Father Malachi Martin, as read by Dr. Gene Scott, the late Dr. Gene Scott of Faith Center in California. Malachi Martin is someone who I interviewed myself on WMUZ some years ago. Very interesting man. I gave a whole rundown of his history last week. He was a man who knew and was known by popes. He was a Jesuit. He was somewhat of influence. More interestingly, he was the man who William Peter Blatty, the author of The Exorcist, used as his pattern for Father Marin. It was actually Father Martin, because Malachi was an archaeologist, among other things, and he participated in many exorcisms. And the book Hostage of the Devil is an account of some of those exorcisms. And we played a bit of that last week. I'm afraid we left you hanging. It was quite an interesting story. It's my intention to continue it this week. So we have all of those issues hanging out there, and I promise to take them each up and continue them. I think next, after the segments on Father Martin, I think we're going to go back to the book of Ezra, the book of Second Ezra, because there's very important prophecies there. So, God willing, and lack of technical problems as we invade the territory of the Prince of the Power of the Air. We are invading his space, his airways. We will be continuing with the series Hostage of the Devil, as read by Dr. Gene Scott. Recall last week we had several demonic encounters described, some rather terrifying ones, as a matter of fact. And we want to continue because they were rather interesting. Going down the menu to try to find it, I had it queued up and it got away from me. Stand by, I'm going to start some music and segue right into the tape.
I'm reading from the book, Hostage to the Devil. The true factual details from tape recordings, interviews of exorcist and exorcist, tape recordings of the exorcism, which is why in this book, translated literally, from the tape recordings of the exorcism are some of the most vile expressions incapable of being read on TV, and it's difficult to read the full exorcism throughout and pick and choose that which can be read. And we had come up to the point of breakthrough in the exorcism. We left it there with the word then, and had gone back and traced the history of the exorcist, the priest. I didn't take his history down to his visit with the Pope and his training with an Irish priest at the Vatican, referred to as Connor in this story, who had isolated the six stages of exorcism: presence, pretense, breakthrough, voice, clash, and expulsion. The mentor of this particular priest in the first case, whose teachings served him good stead as he encountered the third and last exorcism of his life and the worst one. And I was reading the background of the exorcee, Mary Ann, to a strange experience that we stopped at in Bryant's Park in New York City. That's where we were, isn't it? And then I asked, do you want me to continue? It's Halloween. And I'm not... all the phones didn't ring, did they? Be honest. Be honest. You might need an exorcism from a lying demon tonight. You're lying to me. Test you again. I want these people to go home honest tonight. I saw some phones on a hook. Either I'm blind or you're lying. How many of you really interested in this? You never show this much vinegar when I'm raising money at this hour. I'm thinking. I have a soft side, you know. I didn't get a single $1 million pledge during that song. Did I? See, the story of Mary Ann is one of the most graphic stories of the progression up to the very moment of demon possession. Then what follows? A visit by her brother, who was the only one that could get to her in her state. A falling into a convulsion in his presence. Being taken home. Exhausting medical remedies. Eventually contacting the church. And Peter being assigned the exorcism. And he was at the breakthrough point in the scene that we left with the word then. I'm trying to ask myself, with that brief a summary, can you comprehend the details of the exorcism, or do I have to skip along and give you a little longer history of Mary Ann up to the point of her demon possession and the collapsing in the park and what followed? I gotta think. I can string this out for 6 years. You don't doubt that, do you? Hate to sin. I could have read some of that while I've been thinking. Ain't I irritating? Halloween's over. I shouldn't wait until next year anyway. Isn't it over? Whose calendar do you go by? Halloween's over at midnight. You'll lie about anything tonight, won't you? Only once in that early time did she cause any commotion. She came to Bryant Park one morning, sat down for a while, then stood up, stopped. Still facing south with what could have been taken as a beatific gleam in her eyes. Someone passed by carrying a radio blaring music. As the radio came level with her, suddenly she flung her hands to her ears, screamed, spun like a top, and fell hard on her face, her body twitching. A score of people gathered around her. A policeman strolled over with the unspeed of the New York cop. Turn that thing off, pal, he said to the owner of the radio. Almost immediately, a tall man was by the policeman's side. "She's Mary Ann. I will take care of her." He spoke in a voice of authority very clearly. "Are you a relative?" the policeman asked, looking up as he crouched on his haunches beside Mary Ann, laying there on the ground. "I'm the only one she has in this world." The policeman remembered the man touched Mary Ann on the left wrist and spoke quietly. In a few seconds, she awoke, got quickly but unsteadily to her feet. Her face still had the smile. Together, she and the tall man walked slowly away towards Fifth Avenue. "You needn't report it, officer." The policeman heard the words, said evenly, confidently, over the man's shoulder. "I was sure they were father and daughter," he commented later in recalling the incident. "He looked old enough, and they both smiled in exactly the same way." Nothing of a recorded public nature took place again in Mary Ann's case, even though she was already in a state of possession by an evil spirit. No definite sign of that possession, unequivocal in itself, had been visible in her from her childhood days until well into the year following the incident in Bryant Park. Mary Ann grew up with one brother a year younger than she. They spent their first years in Philadelphia. Strongly Roman Catholic, closely knit, Polish origin, second generation American, no living relatives in the United States, few close friends, neither completed high school, the parents, that is, neither had much time for culture, much leisure. Mother was quiet spoken, firm, held a job, continually worried about bills. Father, bluff, down to earth, grew up in the Depression, married late, solidly faithful to his wife, never fretted about difficulties. Outside his working hours, spent all his spare time at home. Both children were reared to lead an orderly existence. Religion occupied a prominent place in their lives. Prayers in common recited mornings and evenings. The Polish pastor was the ultimate authority. In those early years, there was such a strong resemblance between Mary Ann and George, her younger brother, they were often mistaken for twins. When their mother or father called them, either of them could answer by mimicking perfectly the voice of the other. They had special signs, words of their own, a kind of private language they could use. Mary Ann relied on George to a great extent. She was left-handed, had begun to speak normally only at the age of 6, and was very shy and obstinate. That was the trait everyone remembered. This close companionship between the two children was broken when around Marion's 8th birthday, the family moved to New York. Story of his popularity in school, Mary Ann beginning to get more withdrawn. After finishing high school, she spent 2 years at Manhattanville College, where her academic interests were physics and philosophy. But her stay there was stormy and unhappy. She wanted the full truth, to know it all, she told her teachers in the first flush of enthusiasm. But with time, she seemed to get cynical and disillusioned, and gave the impression she believed they were evading the real problem, hiding the full truth. She found particular difficulty with her metaphysics teacher, a certain Mother Virgilius, middle-aged, myopic, high-voiced, a disciplinarian and member of the old school. She became very argumentative in her classes. Not a learning kind of argument, but a contest between her and her teacher, trying to catch her, it seemed. Without going through some of their arguments, in one of them she got angry and Mary Ann was on her feet, swept up her books, glared at everyone, and was out the door. She refused to return to Manhattanville. To all questions as to why and to all entreaties that she give it another chance, she kept repeating, They're trying to enslave my mind. I want to be free, to know all reality, to be real. She then began to be critical of everyone but herself. Contemptuous. Deciding everybody else was a phony. Gradually, she extended this premise. All authorities in my life are phonies. Her parents knew nothing of philosophy, and when Marianne spoke of some of these things, they only knew and loved her. But manifestations of that love were taken to Marianne as chains thrown around her. Her rebellion broke out into horrible and cruel fights with her parents. Cruel on her side. I'm skipping. After much discussion, she went to Hunter College, fall semester 54. Purely secular school. Academically, she never had any difficulty. But the rhythm of family life changed around this time. George had gone off to study oceanography. Her father frequently out of town. Her mother working. Real contact with Marianne ended by the end of her first year at Hunter. Her contemporaries at college remembered her primarily as one who rarely laughed, spoke in a low voice, had few friends, gave evidence of great stubbornness when an argument arose. Neither they nor her family knew anything about her first meeting with the man. The man who appeared in the park. Am I boring you? During her first 2 years at college, Marianne used to go downtown and sit in Washington Square Park reading her textbooks and making notes. One afternoon in 1956, as she was reading William James, Varieties of Religious Experience, she felt suddenly, without any sense of shock, that someone was bending over her shoulder and looking at the pages of her book. She looked around. He was a rather tall individual whose face and clothes never impressed themselves on her memory. His left hand was resting on the back of the park bench. Her one clear memory is only of his mouth, and the regular teeth she glimpsed behind his lips as he read repeatedly from the open page of her book the words, quote, "When you find a man living on the ragged edge of his consciousness, running all the words as one sentence several times over and over again without pause or stop, the mouth kept repeating and repeating, on the ragged edge of consciousness, on the ragged edge of consciousness, on the ragged edge of consciousness, on the..." It was done softly, without hurry, without emphasis, until the words became a slowly whirling carousel in her ears, and her mind moved in circles, bumping against them on all sides. She burst into tears. The mouth said, still softly, "They're all pushing you along the ragged edge. Want to get off?" She remembers a few things. She said through her tears, "I don't want them." Obviously, she's going to be exercised. And then her memory gives this record. She remembers a few things. She said through her tears, "I don't want them to help me, just to leave me alone." He sat with her for about 1 hour. The left hand remained visible in her memory. And the mouth. She remembers nothing else of him. Except that there were instructions. Don't let any man touch you. You have a short time to reach your true self. Come and find me regularly. And there was one peculiar instruction. Seek those of the kingdom. They will know you. You will know them. It was from this time that her family and acquaintances noticed definite changes in Marianne. She disappeared from home for long mornings and afternoons. Even when there were no lectures or lab work at college, she spoke rarely of her parents. Her meals at home grew less frequent. Her contemporaries at Hunter noticed that she became more introspective, more fearful of strangers, more reticent with those who knew her, extremely shy. Her mother became worried. After much persuasion, she induced Marianne to see a psychiatrist. But after a couple of sessions, he dismissed her. He told her parents that while she certainly needed more nourishment, she'd been losing weight, and much love, he could detect nothing awry or dangerous in her psychology. She just wanted to be free, and this was, he said, the new generation. Anyway, he advised them, they should think of her age. Rebellion and independence were normal for her age bracket. The father was satisfied. Her mother felt some continued apprehension. By the time they realized that I was in earnest about the change in me, says Marianne, I had already accepted the authority of the man. I had changed profoundly. I mean, my inner lifestyle altered under his influence. Marianne always refers to this figure as, quote, the man. But nowadays, it is impossible for her to determine if he was a hallucination, deliberate figment of her own, a real person, or merely a metaphor and symbol of her initial revolt, asked the cop. Hallucinations of that nature are generally not shared with strangers. I just threw that in. Indeed, in Marianne's memory of the 9 years between that first meeting with the man and the exorcism of 1965, the man keeps on appearing and reappearing in her recollections. But most of the time, especially the last 4 years, is nearly a total blank. Only a few searing experiences stand out starkly for her. Postgraduate work at New York University. She lived sporadically with various men, didn't take care of her external appearance, spoke disparagingly, sometimes very rudely and with four-letter words, of all that her parents held dear. She didn't allow them to bother her. For their part, her parents worried greatly. She went down from 130 to 95 pounds. In great anguish and confusion, her mother ceased leaving food packages at the door of Marianne's apartment. When the first one was delivered back, smelling and dripping, Marianne had mixed excrement and urine with the fruit and sandwiches and sent it back to her mother. In her memory now, the next big step in her changing inner lifestyle, as she terms it, concerned formal religion and religious belief. She took that step consciously. Am I boring you? With the man by her side, and on two particular occasions. One occasion was on Palm Sunday. In the evening, as she passed by a church, services were being conducted. Something about the lights of this particular church, turn my mic up, aroused her interest. It was in the nature of a challenge, she recalls. She entered and stood among the people at the back of the church. Suddenly, she felt the same disgust and rejection then as she had experienced toward her parents and teachers. As she turned to go, the man beside her turned also. He had been there, but she hadn't noticed him. "Had enough, my friend?" he said quietly, jocularly. She saw his smile in the half-darkness and smiled back at him. He said, "The smile of the kingdom is now yours." Then as they left, "If you don't like it, you haven't got to lump it, you know." They both smiled. That was all. The second occasion took place the next week at Easter. An illuminated cross was set up on the general building on Park Avenue. She was viewing this from the corner of 56th Street and Park Avenue when she heard the man nearby say, "Seems one-sided. Shouldn't they turn it upside down also? Just in order to balance the odds. Same thing, really, only in perfect balance. The man smiled. For me, comments Marianne now, it was a perfect smile. You hadn't to balance it up with a scowl, perfect for me then. At home that night, she found herself drawing inverted crosses side by side with upright crosses. But she could not bring herself to draw the crucified figure on either type of cross. Whenever she tried, the pencil ran away in S shapes and Z shapes and X shapes. From that time on, there started in earnest what she recalls as a new color and form in my inner life. Her descriptions of it are confused. But the overall meaning of what she says is chilling. The whole process was an acquisition, as she called it, of the naked light and her marriage with nothingness, expression she learned from the man. It tells of some of her continued encounters. One encounter with a young man she picked up on Third Avenue. When they finished their lovemaking, she scared the liver out of him. The details can't be read. From now on, as she remembers it, Marianne's development went in two quick stages. The first stage was very rapid. It consisted of a total independence. Except insofar as she needed them for survival or pleasure, she no longer bothered about anyone or anything. She had no more decisions to make about being morally good or evil, whether life was good or bad, worth quitting or worth continuing, whether she was liked or disliked, whether she liked or disliked herself, whether she met her obligations or shirked them. The second stage was more difficult, went by fits and starts. It began with a near adoration of herself. It ended in her, as she said it, marriage with nothingness and the fullness of the naked light. It became clear during her exorcism a few years later that these were terms that described her total subjection to an evil spirit. She came to monitor her perceptions closely and scrupulously. At first, she was fascinated by her perceptions. They came with a startling freshness, appearing to be utterly original in their source, herself. She became, in her own eyes, a genius with a single vision. She found the company of others exasperating and destructive. To talk with another softened the sharp edge of her perception. To do anything with another meant clothing herself in false clothes, not being wholly herself. Before she achieved absolute isolation, whenever she returned from a conversation or a meal with others, it was very difficult for her to regain the inner space and single vision she had possessed before such contacts. As she reached more and more permanent mastery of her isolation, she came to realize that the self she sought lay beyond and beneath and behind, to use her expressions, the world of her psychophysical actions and reactions. She slowly became more sensitive and expectant that she would find the self she sought, wrapped in semi-transparent shadows. I want to try to skip through this. She has vague memories of continuing to be instructed by the man, of seeing him regularly, of listening to him talk, of obeying some dictates he gave. The end of her striving came one day in Bryant Park, to skip along. She was seeking some subliminal flow, to skip over a lot of complicated phrases. She had entered cautiously, feeling the flow of all present, ready to flee if any disturbance came her way, and we're back to Bryant Park. He was sitting languidly on a bench, doing nothing in particular, staring vacantly into space. Sitting down at the other end of the bench, Marianne gazed vacantly on the passing scene. In the morning sunlight, beneath a sky cleansed by a light breeze, the traffic hummed with the busy purposefulness of other human beings about their day's work. School children, office workers, turn me up, passed by on their different ways. The pigeons were feeding. It could not have been a more peaceful city scene. Then, in a quick instant, Fuja, some tremendous pressure seemed to fall all around Marianne from head to toe like a net. She shivered. And then some invisible hand seemed to have pulled a tightening cord so that the net slipped through every inch of her body and out herself, tightening and tightening. As the net contracted in size, passing through my outer person, it gathered and compressed every particle of myself, she would say in later years. Marianne no longer saw or felt any sensation of sunlight or wind. The outer world had become a flat and painted picture, neither fresh nor hot nor cold. And the movements of people and animals and objects were angular tracings with no depth, no coherent sound. All meaning was drained from the scene. The only movement was within her. Bit by bit, the net, now like a sharp, all-surrounding hand, tightened, narrowing, and narrowing all my consciousness. At every moment under that pressure, she was opening up every secret part of myself, saying, yes, 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 to a power that would not take no for an answer. And none who saw her, a young girl sprawled motionless on the bench in the sunlight, could guess that Marianne was becoming a casement of possession. Without any warning, the pressure ceased. The net had been drawn tight. She was held invincibly, securely. And then she realized, like waking up from sleep, that some kind of mist or fog was lifting from her consciousness, allowing her a new sensation. She now knew that all along, all her life, she had been very near to dusk and accompanying darkness. Even as she once more saw the grass, trees, men, women, children, animals, sun, sky, building, with their indifference and innocence in her regard, she now saw also this dusk everywhere. The dusk crept into her. The dusk crept into her. Like a snake slithering easily and lazily into a favorite hole, bringing with it twilight rustlings of such smoky transparencies, such opaque light, and such brightest shadows that a thrill ripped through her whole being. What entered her seemed to be personal, to have an turn the lights off. What entered her seemed to be personal, to have an individual identity, but of such seductive repulsiveness that the thrill she felt stung her with a pain pleasure she had never dreamed possible. She felt her whole being going quiet, self-aware, dissolving all the cobwebs. It was like falling in love with the open jaws of an alligator. Each splotch of its saliva, each hook of its teeth, each crevice in its mouth was animal, just animal and personal. All the while, she kept on repeating, yes, silently as if answering a request for marriage or a demand for surrender. Time seemed to stand still, as a bestiary of animal sounds and smells and presences gradually flowed into her consciousness and mingled there with the sounds of children laughing, the tones of workmen nearby calling out jokes or snatches of conversation from couples passing along the pathway. All the sounds that had enlivened the morning when she had entered Bryant Park now seeped with a new odor of old and new corrupting things of corruption. The cool snap of the air and the sound of the traffic were marinated in a fluid of grunts, snarls, hisses, bellowings, helpless bleedings. The blue of the sky, the shining faces of the skyscrapers, the green of the grass, all the colors around her were, according to her memory, suffused in wreaths of black, browns, reds. It was the balance she had always sought. I have finally stepped into the locus of myself, she reflected. It had always been there, of course. This was the wonder and awe of it all. And the core of that wonder was finding it to be nowhere. In a room with an empty chair that did not exist, bare walls that faded into nothingness, and she herself at last seen as a final illusion dissipated and annihilated into nothing full oneness. She stood up to go, overjoyed with her newfound thrill of balance, but she was whiplashed back to the clamorous and unwanted sense by music from a portable radio on the arm of a passerby. The snake resting inside her had suddenly coiled like a whipcord and was lashing out at the attempted entry of any singular beauty or grace. She felt herself falling and whirling, falling and whirling. It was as if inside her head a little flywheel had broken loose and was whipping itself into a high-pitched scream. As it sped faster and faster, the ground came up, hit her across the forehead. But the real suffering was deep inside her. Never did I know such sadness and pain, she said. When I walked away with the man's help, he said little. His words burned themselves into my memory. Don't fear. You have now married nothingness and are of the kingdom. I understood it all without understanding anything at all with my intellect or reason. I said, yes, yes, all of me belongs now. Nothing. Nothing was ever the same again until after I was exorcised. It was not so much what Marianne had learned. It was rather what she had become. I was not another person. I was the same. Only I was convinced I had become free. By being totally independent and by what had entered me and taken up residence inside me. Want me to quit?
No, sir.
How many want me to quit? Open the door. Anyone who wants to go, it's okay. I don't give that break very often. Anybody want to go? Hey, this ain't no National Enquirer. Hostage to the Devil by Malachi Martin. Heralded by Professor of Social Philosophy, New York University, Chairman of Department of Applied Theology, Harvard University, Rector of Trinity Church Episcopal, New York, Professor of Clinical Psychology, Loyola University, Chicago. A factual record of demon possession and exorcism of five Americans in the 60s and 70s. Just to confirm herself and her conviction, she went to a psychiatrist, laughed at his cliches. A second psychiatrist told me I need to travel, get away from it all. From now on, as far as any outside observer after those two trips to a psychiatrist, Marianne's course was a deterioration. After the marriage with nothingness in Bryant Park, some fixed moorings seemed to have been severed. She encouraged all forms of sexual intercourse with men and women. Never found anyone willing to satisfy her, though she says it a different way. Some of the descriptions can't be read. The few neighborhood people who saw her with any frequency, to skip on, began to think she was peculiar. She rarely spoke. In shops, she would point to what she wanted to buy or hand it to the shopkeeper with a grunt. She never looked him in the eye. all had a vague feeling of threat or danger, some indefinable sense of an unknown fire in her as long as she stood near them. Her parents tried to see her several times, but could speak to her only through the locked door of her apartment. Her language to them was littered with obscenities. Once the neighbors heard dull thuds and crashes for 4 to 5 hours. Finally, overcoming the reluctance of East Village apartment dwellers to interfere with anyone, they called the police. The door had to be forced. The smell in the room was stomach-curdling, and they couldn't understand the freezing temperature, while outside New York sweltered in the humidity of high summer. The room was in chaos. On the floor, around the bed and table, in the closets, bathroom, and kitchenette, there were thousands of torn sheets of paper covered with indecipherable scrawls. Mary Ann was lying across the bed, one leg bent beneath her, a little blood dropping from the corner of her mouth, her eyes open and sightless. She was breathing regularly, though. An ambulance called by someone arrived just when Mary Ann stirred and sat up. She took in the scene in one glance. Quickly, her face changed. She spoke in a normal voice and assured them that all was well. She had fallen, she said, from a chair while fixing the curtains. Police don't want trouble, she comments in recalling the incidents to Cole now. And anyway, I radiated too much power and self-confidence. The only thing I wanted to do was shout obscenities in their faces. You missed it all. And what she describes is beyond belief. What really had happened to her, and in terms I can't describe, but the encounter was with a, as she calls it, a big-bellied spider. But there was no point in saying that to the cops. They left her alone. During all this time, Mary Ann always smelled bad. She seemed to have constant cuts and bruises on her shins and the back of her hands. She never displayed any emotion except when confronted with religious symbols. The sound of church bells, the sight of a nun or a priest, the mention of the name Jesus, even when used in an oath or jest. Her brother George, who later went around to her familiar haunts, was told by many that at such moments she seemed to shrink inside herself like somebody under a rain of blows. Violence to others was rare. On one occasion, a schoolgirl with a collection box for a local church cause got a reaction where Mary Ann screamed through her teeth, fell into violence of weeping, shielding her hands, kicking violently at the girl's shins. On the front of the box, she still recalls there was a crucified figure together with the name of Jesus. On the other hand, she repelled threatening violence rather easily. In the dusk of one October evening at the corner of Leroy Street, she was accosted by a mugger. She remembers clearly that he made his first move at her from behind. She turned her face deliberately to him, displaying the full extent of that twisted smile to him. Yes, my brother. He stopped as if he had run up against an invisible brick wall and stood staring. He seemed unexpectedly and painfully bruised. Then, with a scared glance, he backed away from her and took to his heels. About May 1965, things were brought to a head. Mary Ann's brother returned to New York for an extended visit. He went to her various haunts, heard stories that shocked him, went to his parents, received the reports of what she was doing, decided to go and see her, was warned she probably wouldn't let him in. That skips through several paragraphs. You'll see, son, his mother said, she won't stand for you taking a religious object as she asked him to take a crucifix. To humor her, George took the crucifix, put it in his pocket, promptly forgot about it, and went downtown to see Mary Ann. It was the first time George and Mary Ann had met in about 8 years. And he was also the first of her immediate family she had consented to see in about 6 years. Mary Ann seemed visibly delighted to see him in her one-room apartment. But George, sitting and listening to her talking softly talking slowly in a soft staccato voice, knew immediately that something was indeed wrong with his sister, that some very deep change had taken place in her. She was still recognizable to him as his sister, The mannerisms he had known in the earlier years were visibly there. She still had the family face, which he shared with her. But as George told it, she seemed to have seen something which constantly filled her mind even while talking to me. She was speaking for the benefit of somebody else's ear, repeating what somebody else was telling her. He had a funny feeling that made him look foolish to himself. She was not alone, and he knew it. But he couldn't get the sense of it all. He was not only puzzled by her behavior, but by its effect on him. She frightened him. George normally didn't frighten easily, and he never had felt fear with any of his immediate family. He was slightly reassured when several times during the conversation he saw glimmers of the personality he had known in their young years when they were inseparable companions. But at those moments, she seemed to be appealing for help or trying to overcome some obstacle he could not define, and she couldn't tell him. Then the wave of fear would come on him again, and he remembered his mother's voice as she spoke to him earlier that day. "You'll see, she won't stand for it." Partly out of curiosity, partly to satisfy his mother's request, he decided to hide the crucifix in the room as his mother had asked him. When Mary Ann went to the bathroom, George placed the small crucifix under her mattress. No sooner had Mary Ann returned and sat on the edge of the bed than she turned white as chalk and fell rigidly to the floor, where she lay jerking her pelvis back and forth as though in great pain. In seconds, the expression on her face had changed from dreamy to almost animal. She foamed at the mouth and bared her teeth in a grimace of pain and anger. George ran out and called his parents on a payphone. They arrived about 3/4 of an hour later, bringing the family doctor with them. That night, they took Mary Ann to their home in Upper Manhattan. There followed weeks of nightmare for her parents and George. They now had full access to her. She lay in what the doctor loosely described as a coma. She would, however, wake up irregularly, take a little nourishment, fall into paroxysms of growling and spitting, was always incontinent and had to be washed continually, and finally would lapse back into the strange comatose state. Sometimes they would find her wandering around the room in the middle of the night, stumbling over the furniture in the darkness, her face frozen into a horrible smile. Drugs and alcohol were ruled out as causes of her condition. Hospitalization was considered and rejected. Although she was undernourished, their doctor and a colleague of his could find nothing organically wrong, no trace of disease or injury. From the beginning, her father insisted that their parish priest come to their home, where Mary Ann now lay, but each visit was catastrophic. It was as if she knew in advance that the priest was coming. She had terrifying fits of rage and violence. She would awaken, endeavor to attack the priest, pour out a stream of obscenity, tear her own skin, try to jump out their 15-story window, or start battering her head against the wall. There were constant disturbances. The door of her room would never stay either open or shut. It was continually banging to and fro. Shall I continue?
Yes, sir. Well, as you can see, as you can hear, Pastor Scott described the condition of a young girl as she was becoming possessed. And as you might anticipate, he's setting up for the battle for her soul that will be coming. And I probably will play that next week so that people don't forget. But this, again, was from the book Hostage of the Devil, by Father Malachi Martin. You heard him briefly go over some of his credentials, so this is a very serious book. So I hope you'll join us next week so that you can hear the rest of this story. Thank you and good night.